This week on Out of the Air features region bassist with the Billy Foster Trio, Bruce Evans, whose credits include Tom Milo's Big Band, Gary Civic Symphony, and Valparaiso University Faculty Jazz Trio. Next, Father Stephen Kerher and George Zerinci discuss their new original musical, The Bluff, at Footlight Players. Our spotlights on Chicago Street Theater's Halloween-themed productions with the musical Lizzie for adults and Scary Godmother for the kids.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. And is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. I'd like to welcome back to Art on the Air Spotlight from the Chicago Street Theater, and they'll be doing a whole new season of Halloween shows, something for the adults, something for the kids, and we have Michael Glorioso. He's directing the first one, Lizzie, which is October 10th through the 26th, and then for the kids, we have Scary Godmother, and it's going to be running kind of like, I guess you might say, in repertory. Michael, welcome back to Art on the Air Spotlight.
It's great to be back. Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, it's always fun to catch up with you, Mike.
Oh, yeah. It's nice that I'm back in the Halloween genre. I've been away from it for just a little while, which is a nice break. But I'm back, and I'm excited about this show.
So tell us a little bit about Lizzie. What's it about? I think most people know it's probably about Lizzie Borden. But you go ahead and tell us all about Lizzie.
Yeah, it's about Lizzie Borden. It's a different take on it. A lot of information out about Lizzie is, you know, people have seen the Christina Ricci made for TV movie, and also those other shows about her. The one with the lady from Bewitched, her name escapes.
Elizabeth Montgomery.
Yes, thank you. Yes, Elizabeth Montgomery was made for TV as well. This is taking the Lizzie story and turning it kind of in a rock and roll genre. So it's kind of like Six Before Six. it takes place with the four ladies that are in the house, Lizzie, her sister Emma, their maid Bridget, and then also the neighbor Alice. And it tells a story about actually what was happening prior to the murders and what led up to it as well. And it takes a rock and roll twist to it. So the first act starts out very like in a lot of the contemporary garb, a lot of the stuff from the turn of the century. And then it breaks out into the second act to like a more rock and roll punk style of show. The music's all really great. It does follow the thing as if Lizzie did it and explores that piece of it. Although a lot of it's still an unsolved case. No one knows if she did it or not, but it's a wonderful show with just four women. And we also have three incredible dancers that are involved with it too. One in which is a male.
And so this is a musical. I guess I didn't, when I was looking at the synopsis, I didn't quite catch that. So that's an interesting take on the musical then.
Yeah. And it's been in development for a while, and it's actually been on my radar for a while. It's the music, like I said, is phenomenal. It kind of incorporates like a lot of that rock and roll, but also like very soft and delicate pieces too, because a lot of the Lizzie story deals with the rage and the why did she do it? What kind of possessed a woman to do it? And that was also one of those things that really was intriguing about the case itself, because a lot of people said how brutal the crimes were, that a woman couldn't possibly have done this to her father and her stepmother. So that's kind of, I think, why she was acquitted, actually, in the original court case.
Right.
So are the four main characters, are they playing instruments or are they singing?
No, they're just singing. And there's some movement involved with it, too. The band will actually be on stage with our actresses as well. And which creates also that really nice rock concert feel to it too. Right. And there'll be, it's unlike Six, there'll be movement and things they're not stuck behind a microphone singing most of it. They actually can move around the set. There is a set that's involved with it as well. So it's going to be a really exciting, fun time. A little bit of blood, a little bit of loud loud bangings and other things too. So a little bit of trigger warnings for
Yeah, there's a lot of energy to it, even though there are the softer moments. It's highly energetic.
Very much so. Very much so.
Well, you have another show that's running kind of like in repertory with this, more for the kids, yes, called Scary Godmother. And I think, as you said, Donna Henry is directing that one.
Yes, Donna Henry is taking that helm up to do Scary Godmother. We did it a couple of years back for the kids. It's same as the book, a book series of the same title. And I believe there was a short little animated movie that was out for it, too. Mm-hmm. It takes place, on Halloween in a scary house. So we're using the same set that we use for Lizzie. And then it's all done with kids. So we have an entire kids and teen cast, everyone under the age of 17 that's involved with it. And that takes place in rep with Lizzie. So on those 12:30 and 2:30 days, they'll be doing the show before Lizzie does their show at 8 o'clock or 2:30 on the weekends. So yeah, so it was really fun. Good opportunity for the family to come out and have something too.
Right. And moving on from the October, which would be kind of an interesting combination of shows, in November you have something that's kind of very special for everyone.
Yeah. Charlie Brown Christmas. That's everyone remembers the Charlie Brown Christmas special that was out. Yeah. Wonderful show. Again, it's going to have, a kid cast and then also an adult cast, which is going to be very interesting. Lisa, our wonderful artistic director, is directing that one along with her sister, Gina. And that's going to be really great for them as well. Something nice for the holidays.
Yeah, that's going to run like starting in late November all the way through December. So, and of course, yeah, as you indicated, the Charlie Brown Christmas was kind of groundbreaking in terms of animated television, taking a comic strip and putting it onto a thing and became a perennial favorite and everything. So,
yeah, I know that's something that I watch every year too. And then also after that, we have The Half-Life of Marie Curie in February. And then after that, Jellofish, written by our very own Jim Henry. And he's also directing that, which is going to be great. And then we wrap up our season with Rye the Cyclone, which is very anticipated for this area. I think a lot of our college-age kids and our our new generation of actors are really excited about that one. I'll be directing that one as well.
Wow.
At the end of the year, with the help of Lisa.
Busy times at Chicago Street Theater. Real quickly, rough show dates for your Halloween series.
Yes, the Halloween series, again, it will open with Lizzie on the 10th of October, and it will run till the 26th, and then Scary Godmother will open the next day on the 11th and run to the 26th as well.
That's Michael Glorioso from the Chicago Street Theater, Lizzie in October, and also Scary Godmother. Thank you so much for coming on Art of the Air Spotlight.
You're welcome. Thank you, Bull.
Yeah, thank you. What a great lineup. Woo!
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Emberforge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
Hey, this is Bela Fleck, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We we are happy to welcome Bruce Evans to Art on the Air. Bruce is retired from multiple careers, a music educator, school librarian, and an adjunct jazz bass instructor. He was also a performing bassist with the Valparaiso University Faculty Jazz Trio. For over 30 years, he played bass with the Tom Milo Big Band and the Tom Milo Beachcombers. He is currently a member of the Billy Foster Trio and the Gary Civic Symphony Orchestra. Thanks for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Bruce. It's very nice seeing you again.
Thank you. It's very nice seeing you again.
Yes, and we just saw each other at the Chesterton Art Fair you guys were there. It's always, actually, that old Billy Foster Trio ends up being one of the favorites of the music at the fair.
But, oh, wow.
But we're interested, and our audience is always interested, in your origin story. And I always like to tee it up by saying how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Bruce.
Okay. Well, although I grew up in Gary, I was actually born in Detroit. But my parents left there when I was just an infant, and we moved to Gary. And that's where I grew up. Started school there at Douglas Elementary School. Then we moved again to the Tolleston area, where I enrolled in the Beveridge Elementary School. Went first grade through the sixth grade there, and then when I was ready for junior high, I went to Tolleston, which was at that time a junior and senior high school. So I spent my years in grades 7 through 12 at Tolleston, where I graduated in 1965. But to back up, I always had an interest in music. I sang in my church choir. They called it the junior choir. I sang there when I was a youngster. But when I got to Tolleston in the seventh grade, I decided I wanted to play an instrument. So fortunately, there was a very vibrant band program there under the leadership of Mr. Edmund Bilski, who was my first music teacher. And I wanted to play the trumpet. I had my heart set on playing the trumpet. I don't know why. I just liked that instrument. Well, he said, I'm sorry, Bruce, but we don't have any trumpets available. And I don't know he was steering me somewhere else or not. But I ended up on the tuba. I was just happy to play something. So I started on the tuba in the seventh grade and continued on in high school playing the tuba. I always had first chair. I was a hungry musician.
You practiced.
And I practiced. I can remember the times I lived about 10 blocks from school, and I would walk home with that sousaphone on my shoulder there and back. I was so interested in learning how to play that instrument. And then also during the summers, they had a summer band program, and I picked up some additional instruments on the side, such as the clarinet and the French horn. And I enjoyed those instruments as well. But I did not play the bass. I looked at a string bass in the band room, and I tried to teach myself, you know, how to play it. But I got frustrated. I just wasn't getting anywhere with it. So I really didn't play bass at all during my early years in school. But when it was time to go to college, when I graduated in 65, I found out that another person named Billy Foster went to the same college, Defiance College. So our parents got us together, and we found out we were going, you know, to the same college, and we became instant friends because we had so much in common. We loved the music. Actually, I had seen Billy around town, even though we attended different high schools. Billy graduated from Frabel, and I graduated from Tolleston. But since we were both involved in music, Billy was a saxophone player, baritone sax player. I don't know if you knew that or not. And I would see him at the all-city events, all-city band. You'd have to audition for the all-city band, and they took people from all over the city. So I actually saw Billy there, but I didn't know him. So I had seen him before, but we didn't actually meet until it was time to go to college. So once that happened, and we found out we were going to Defiance College, and there was an instant friendship there. And Billy actually mentored me in jazz. I mean, I didn't really know much about jazz, but Billy was already into it. I mean, he was really gung-ho about jazz even then. So he had me listen to all these recordings he had. He was always telling me about, you know, how much fun he was having playing jazz. And he was also in the college dance band or jazz band called the DCs at Defiance College. And, I got to hang around with Billy and the guys in the band. So I had some interest in it, but I wasn't in the band at that point. I went to college as a pre-med major. I was going to become a doctor, but I couldn't stay away from the music. So to my mother's chagrin, I switched my major in my sophomore year. I switched it to music education, but I was happy. I felt, you know, that this was what I wanted to do, and this is what I was going to pursue. So going back to the DCs, the college dance band, the bass player in that band couldn't make a job because the band performed on weekends, you know, for various functions, for proms, whatever. They gave a student something to do, a little way to make some money. But at that time, I didn't know anything about playing the bass. But the bass player, on this one occasion, something came up and he couldn't do the job. But the band had a contract to play this job, this music job. They needed somebody, you know, to stand in for him. So they asked me to do it for some reason. I didn't know anything about the bass. I didn't know the G string from the E. I didn't know anything about
You were
bass.
Nice and tall, though, maybe,
I
right?
was nice and tall. So they hired me for that one night to stand up and pretend. I hope I don't get in trouble for this. Pretend like I was playing the bass. And I was so nervous. I was mortified. But somehow I got through the night. And I said, you know what? I was so embarrassed. I said, I'm going to learn how to play this instrument legitimately. So after that incident, I set about, again, trying to teach myself how to play. And, of course, with Billy's encouragement, the recordings that we listened to, that just gave me even more incentive. I heard this guy named Ron Carter, who played with the Miles Davis Band. And I said, oh, that's the way the bass is supposed to sound. And so he became, I was like a little duck that kind of gravitated toward his mother. So he became my model for how to shape my bass playing. So I became good enough on the bass that when the regular bass player decided he didn't want to do it anymore, I stepped right in and had so much fun learning. Yeah. So after jumping ahead, after I graduated in 1969, I decided that I was going to take some lessons from a professional, you know, bass teacher, string bass teacher. And that's what I did. So I studied with Mr. Harold Siegel, who played with the Chicago Symphony. I studied with him for a number of years. And then afterwards, I studied with Greg Sarge, who's a bassist in the Lyric Opera. So I learned how to use the bow, all my fingerings and scales, arpeggios, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Billy decided he wanted to start a group. And since we were from the same hometown in Gary, we were right there together. It was just a natural thing that we would hook up. So that's how I got started on the string bass.
You still keep up with the brass?
No.
No?
I think I still have my tuba mouthpiece, but I sold my French horn. I didn't buy a French horn. I sold that and bought a bass.
There you go.
Well, at least if you're starting out with a tuba, you're familiar with the good old bass clef, you know. That's
right.
Like being a trumpet player, you know, that's what I did. You know, the bass clef was kind of this mystery to me sometimes. It's like, oh, wait a minute. You know, I can look, read the notes there, but you get down to the bass clef, I'm like, well, what's that?
Yeah, right.
So you're hooked up with Billy, and so how do you get into, like, education and some of the other things that you were doing?
A librarian.
Okay. Well, since I was a music education major, naturally, when we graduated, I looked for a job in Gary. I inquired to see if there was anything available so that I could use my education in that area. And fortunately, there was an opening, and I started teaching at Wirt High School in 1969. I was assistant band director at Wirt High School, and I was moved to, I forget the term, but they had to decrease the faculty at that time, and fortunately, Kennedy King Middle School was opening up, so that I just moved right into that job opening, and I stayed there for about 9 years as I actually opened up this school as the band and orchestra director there. And while I was doing that, I decided that I would like to go to Roosevelt University to work on my master's, which I did. So I went to Roosevelt University for a couple years and got my master's degree in music education. I graduated with honors, as did Billy. Billy and I both went to Roosevelt University.
Were you in the same year always then?
Yes, we were always in the same year, right.
So your history with Billy goes quite a bit back there. So when you're performing with him, it's got to be so easy because, you know, jazz is so much about knowing when to come in, go out, and that whole sequence there.
Exactly. Yeah, we were learning together. I mean, he was ahead of me because he had a little head start. But, you know, we learned together, you know, how to play the changes, you know, what a 2-5-1 is.
Right.
Because we didn't know anything, you know, initially. But, you know, from, you know, studying the music and playing with more experienced players. Gary has a rich tradition of musicians who are in jazz, R&B, blues. So when we came back home, we met some of these people. There was a place called Mona's Lounge. I don't know if you ever heard of that, but that was a really special place for going to jam sessions and learning, because these older guys, they let you sit in and see what you could do. So we did a lot of that, and that was very helpful in our development.
Well, Billy, like I imagine, and this is just me from like the outside, I guess, he's so very serious and focused on what he's doing, but he's got a wild sense of humor. So does that show up when all of you are playing? I mean, as an audience member, I see it. You know, he's having a great time, but he's definitely very...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, if you get to know Billy Foster, he will keep you in stitches.
He's so funny.
He's got a wry sense of humor, and his delivery is wonderful. He's a wonderful storyteller, and, you just immediately gravitate to him. You know, we just love Billy.
Laughing all the time.
He's so laid back in his delivery, so kind of straight, and then you hear it, and it's like, oh my gosh, that's great.
Right.
So how did you move into become a librarian?
Oh, okay. Well, I decided towards the end of my career, and I was spent 33 years in the Gary Community School System, I decided I'd like to get into information technology. So I went back to school and took a few courses. And lo and behold, a position opened up at Edison Middle School. And I took that position. I stayed there for 4 years as librarian.
So I want to learn the bass. I'm just being hypothetical here because what's the best approach? I mean, you obviously now do have students, but when they approach you, like whether they be a total novice or just starting, you know, tell us about that process of teaching them how to play the bass.
Okay. Well, I did. in addition to teaching in Gary, I also was adjunct, which I forgot to mention, adjunct professor of jazz bass at Valparaiso University. I started there in the 80s, and I stayed there for, I can't remember exactly how long now, but it was over 20 years. And what I would do when I got a new student was first assess where they were, you know, their complete novice or somebody who had some experience, and I'd kind of tailor my lessons around that. But say, for instance, if you're a rank beginner, I'd probably start you out with the basics of reading notation out of a tutor, like the Simondo, which is a very popular bass tutor. I'd do some of that, and then I'd have some other materials that are geared toward jazz, some jazz literature that I'd use to start out with learning how to play chord changes, how to navigate enough theory so that you could actually play a tune, play a song. So that's the way I start you out.
Are you still teaching?
I no longer teach. I no longer teach.
Just perform.
Just perform.
Well, you know, let's take a quick break here to listen to this is Sunday with Sarah. This is just a little excerpt of You Do It. That's Bruce Evans on the bass. That was Bruce Evans on the bass playing Sunday with Sarah, just a little sample of his work on the bass there.
So sweet. Did you write that? Did you compose that?
No, that was actually composed by the drummer in the trio, Jeff Brown.
Oh, yeah.
And he wrote that for his wife, so hence Sunday with Sarah. But that song was part of, I believe that was on our first CD, that the Valparaiso University Faculty Jazz Trio. Billy, Jeff, and myself, Billy on piano, Jeff on drums, and myself on bass. And each of us contributed at least two or three original compositions. And that Sunday with Sarah, that was one of them. That was recorded in 1999 at the CMC recording studio in Chicago, which is no longer there. But we also did another recording in 2010. It's called Journey. And each of us, most of that CD is originals. I think there's one standard tune, but everything else is written by the three of us. But I've written, I guess, three or four songs that are copyrighted. That's kind of the history of that.
So was Billy part of that, the faculty band as well?
He was, yeah. Not any longer, but yes, he was an original member.
You probably must be sad about how the music program is at Valpo, how it's really gone to almost nothing. It's very, very sad. I mean, I know Jeff Brown for years too, and how he has kind of got, kind of pushed out the door, so to speak, when they were really downsizing or riffing everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because Jeff was very instrumental in building that program. We used to have artists from all over the world, actually, at our annual festivals. So that's really sad.
Yeah. So any more compositions in your future? I mean, is that something that all of a sudden say, you know, I have the need to write something.
No, I don't really have a need to write. I kind of write by necessity. Billy is the one who needs to write. He like writes something every day. He's the writer.
So do you have other, artistic, endeavors, I guess?
No, I think music is about it, but, apart from music, I have an intense interest in genealogy, family history. Wow. So I've been doing that for years, and that's a very rewarding hobby for me.
So how far have you delved back?
I've gone back with parts of my family back to the 15th century.
Wow.
Yeah, mostly on ancestry, I'm on 23andMe Ancestry, Family Tree DNA. I've even done DNA, you know, the DNA to help me with that.
Yeah, I know I've done that too. And I found, well, I was mostly interested because I was wanting to get into the Sons of the American Revolution and found that I had ancestors here, both on sides of my family, maternal and paternal side, that were here before then. So it was interesting.
Wow.
But then I traced some of it back, I think, to about, I think, 15th century or thereabouts, mostly in Germany. So
okay. One of the more interesting things I learned was that I'm distant related to President Obama.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, and my mom and his mom are distantly related. I also learned that, also my mom's side, that one of her ancestors was from the island of Madagascar, which is totally unexpected.
Well, we have a couple of minutes left. You're not teaching anymore, but do you have a website or where people can find out more about you and your music?
I don't have a website, but I am on Facebook. If you look for Bruce Evans on Facebook, you'll find me there. And occasionally I'll post things related to music or what I'm doing. I also play with the Gary Civic Orchestra, which, you know, we have a concert coming up August the 31st at the library from 3 to 5, if anyone's interested in that.
Oh, that's a nice space at the library.
It is. Very nice space.
And anything into the fall that you have going on, like October into December?
Okay. I can't think of anything right offhand. I freelance mostly. I'll let you know.
Yeah, we always like to have that, everything like that. Well, you know, this has been real interesting, Bruce. I know that you were part of the Billy Foster Trio, or actually it's going to be more than a trio, on September 20th that happened at IUN and everything. And you've been a major part of the trio for many, many years and been around. So we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air and sharing your whole life journey and everything from playing the bass to becoming a librarian and currently doing that and everything. Thank you so much for coming on there and sharing your arts journey.
Thank you, Larry. And thank you also, Esther.
Yeah, thank you so much, Bruce.
You're welcome.
Art in the Air listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show? Whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. Our show relies on the support of not only our show underwriters, but also our listeners who make donations to this station. Your support of this station will ensure Art in the Air may continue bringing you the best of the arts and culture programming for Northwest Indiana and beyond. If Art in the Air is important to you, please consider supporting this station with a one-time contribution or even making an ongoing sustaining contribution. For information on how to make a contribution, go to this station's website or our show website, breck.com/AOTA. And thank you.
Hi, this is Morgan McCabe, freelance theater professional and writer for the Northwest Indiana Times. You are listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP 103.1 FM. Thanks for listening.
We would like to welcome Father Stephen Carraher and George Gerinci to Art on the Air. Father Stephen is a theatrical creative from Munster, Indiana, both in performance and directing. His lifelong passion for theater and collaboration culminated most recently in his co-composing the music for The Bluff, an original whodunit musical comedy. George is an electrical engineer from Munster as well. While he has been on stage a few times, he can be found backstage managing light and sound for musicals and plays. He also, for a time, consulted on set construction and lighting design for an international touring musician. George collaborated with the other writers of The Bluff, providing another creative voice. Thank you both for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Father Stephen and George. It's very, very nice meeting you.
Thank you, Esther. Very, very kind. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, it's nice to see you guys again because you're part of my theater program, Munster Theater Company, for many, many years. And so it's good to reconnect. And of course, if you hear Lab during this thing, we refer to me, that's kind of my nickname. Most people out there kind of know that. So, but how we want to start off the show is get your background story. And we'll start with you, Father Stephen. How you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about yourself.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to see you again, Dr. Larry A. Breckner. It's wonderful. my origin story in terms of like my artistic journey really begins over at St. Thomas More in Munster. So I was there from kindergarten to eighth grade. And I remember in third grade watching a musical. They do a musical every single year, which is wonderful. I mean, you don't typically see like many middle school programs or middle schools like do musicals. But at St. Thomas More, they did one every year. And I remember seeing for the first time a musical called Schoolhouse Rock Junior, which was, you know, when I look back now, it's not the highest quality show that has ever been written, but I was just absolutely entranced by it in third grade. I remember like dragging my parents to see every single performance of it. And I remember crying like in my bed, like the night after it was done. And my mom told me that it wasn't going to be performed again next year because the fourth grade was like the first year that I could audition for the show. And I remember crying that I wasn't going to be able to be in this musical. But thankfully, they had another musical the next year, which was Aladdin Jr. I got cast in that and then was in musicals every single year at St. Thomas More. My very last year at St. Thomas More was really special because we had an original musical put on. So one of our directors, Kristen Estes, wrote a musical specifically for kids in middle school to play called Cookie, a half-baked musical. And that kind of really going through that creative process, even in eighth grade of originating a musical, really kind of put into my head like a spark and desire to create, especially theater. And that kind of led me to high school. As Larry mentioned, I'm an alumnus of Munster High School. And I spent four wonderful years in the theater, really getting to know the canon of musical theater. We did a whole bunch of wonderful musicals. We did a couple of things from Stephen Schwartz. We did Children of Eden. We did Pippin. We also, you know, got into Sondheim a little bit with Into the Woods. We did a whole bunch of eclectic musicals. And of course, capping it off, one of my favorites, Fiddler on the Roof, which is very near and dear to my heart. I know it's very dear to Lab's heart as well. Near and dear to George's heart as well. It was such a blessing to be a part of that. During high school, I kind of was also involved with Boy Scouts, which is how I knew George, how I knew the other gentleman who also co-wrote the show with us. And we would very frequently do a whole bunch of collaborations just artistically. And then when eventually I went off to college, I went off to Indiana University. I studied math and computer science there. But I minored in theater, and that really was a time where I got to really sink my teeth into different theatrical traditions and different a couple more musical creators and composers. I really continued to fall in love with the art form, and it was during my time in college that I really felt a call to the priesthood. And through prayer and discernment, really felt the Lord call me to enter seminary to study to be a Catholic priest for the Diocese of Gary, and kind of part of my journey was kind of, you know, realizing, okay, as a priest, I probably won't be able to do as much theater as I thought I'd be doing. Like there probably wouldn't be time to do a lot of, you know, community theater. I always imagined myself coming back to the region and doing community theater for the rest of my life, but realizing that, you know, this commitment is probably going to be, you know, take pretty much everything out of me.
But and it's a theatrical working, as well.
Yeah, certainly. You know, there is a lot of connection between, you know, my theatrical training and what I do on a pretty much on a daily basis, talking in front of people, you know, kind of, you know, being composed in front of an audience, speaking, communicating, all super helpful. You know, I entered seminary and continued to discern, you know, whether or not the Lord was calling me to be a priest. And I remember my last couple of years of seminary, there was the offer was put to me because, believe it or not, in seminary, in a couple of seminaries across the U.S., they have a theater program. So they have some seminarians like direct and put on different plays or musicals. So they said, "Oh, Stephen, you know, you're a guy who studied theater in college and you did a lot in high school. Why don't you direct plays for us?" And so I did that. I did that for a couple of years, and it came to my last year of seminary, and actually got a chance to put on this musical that we're talking about today. So that's my origin story, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, I have a childhood question. So was it a musical family? So what drew you to musical theater? Was it?
Yeah, I'd say my family is quite musical. My mother is a violist, so she played in the Northwest Indiana Symphony for 30 years. After 30,
that's a little connection.
Yeah, it is. After 30 years of playing the same Christmas music over and over again, she said it's time to hang up the bow, you know. I remember, like, as a young kid, you know, my mom would always have people over at the house for lessons. My dad was musical as well. He didn't necessarily play any instruments, but he'd play the piano every once in a while. He has an amazing breadth of knowledge in terms of musicals. He loves, like, your old classics. He loves your, you know, he has a special affection for, like, Guys and Dolls, Hello Dolly, all of those, like, classic golden age kind of musicals. So that kind of really sparked my desire to continue to learn about the art form and eventually create.
Excellent. Let's move on to George. Tell us your origin story, how you got from where you were to where you are now.
Yeah, sure. So I guess my theater origin story sort of starts back in elementary school. My grandfather had done a lot of theater with Genesius Guild and other various theaters in the area. I think the earliest memory I have of theater was going to see him in a production of Inherit the Wind, which was very fun. But all through elementary and middle school, I did some student programs with Genesius Guild. So I think that sort of culminated in a production of Oliver that we did. Sort of didn't really do much of any more theater until I got to high school. Of course, there I met you. Did a lot of the tech theater stuff. Kind of got a much better understanding of that side of things, the offstage side of things. And I continued that track sort of into college. Of course, obviously studying engineering, but in the meantime, had some opportunities to collaborate on a production of, I think we did, I took a break from tech theater stuff to do an onstage production. I was on stage in a production of Your Good Man, Charlie Brown, which was a strange change from earlier offstage work. But
did you enjoy it?
Well, I didn't do any more.
What did you play in Good Man Charlie Brown?
The kid with the blanket. I don't remember.
Oh, Linus.
Linus.
Yes, Linus. Yeah. So it was a lot of fun, but not necessarily what I wanted to continue to do.
So let's talk about the collaboration, how that evolved. You talked a little bit about Father Stephen, a little bit as how it came together. But yeah, tell us about how that now evolved into what's the production that's going on at Footlight Players in September.
Yeah, so the origin of our collaboration begins with neither me nor George. In 2014, it's our senior year of high school, a couple of our friends, Matt and Scott, just finished production on a play called The Happiest Millionaire. Now, Matt was he was the lead in the year previous, and they did a play called Murder at the Orient Express, not Murder on the Orient Express, not the Agatha Christie, Murder at the Orient Express. So it's like a Clue, but it's done in a Chinese restaurant. And he was playing he portrayed like the lead detective, who was a bumbling detective, and he loved it. And so when he was cast as I think he was just an understudy in Happiest Millionaire, he was. First, he was kind of upset because he was the lead and then he wasn't the lead. And, you know, I guess with all of his extra time, he thought to himself, you know what? Maybe we can write a musical. It's probably not that hard. So he goes to his friend Scott a couple days after the Happiest Millionaire closes and says, Scott, and he knows that Scott plays the piano. He plays a lot by ear. Says, Scott, I want to write a musical. And Scott says, absolutely, let's do it. And then Matt comes to him a couple days later with an outline of the score and about 14 songs. And he says, he puts 14 titles in front of Scott and says, all right, how long do you think it's going to take for you to write all of this? I'm basically done with my part.
Wow.
So after a couple of years, they had maybe ideas for about half of those songs. And that's when George and I got introduced to it. Scott and Matt were both, you know, mutual friend of ours. We swam together in a lot of circles. And I remember looking at the score the first time and the script and thinking, wow, this is kind of an interesting musical. It kind of tells the story of this young bumbling detective who wants to really prove his worth to his father. And he goes try to solve the murder case of the wealthiest man in New York in just one day. So I was very fascinated with it. And George was fascinated with it, too. So we began collaborating. And then after about a year or so, we had like a first draft done. We had also a connection with the Toll Theater. We did a scripted reading at the Toll. And we certainly got maybe a rude awakening would be the right way to put it, but it was pretty clear that it wasn't as polished and as finished as we thought. And we kind of came back, we circled the wagons and said, well, what are we going to do? Well, we decided to do like a whole a remodel of the whole show. We changed a couple of characters. We changed a couple of plot points. And I remember probably about like a year and a half into you know, reworking this, we had a read through just among ourselves, and we didn't make it through the first act without just absolutely realizing that it was even worse than the first thing that we made. So then we had a decision to make. It's like, okay, what are we going to do? So we scrapped that whole thing, went back to the drawing board, and then figured that, okay, we can take some pieces from the original script and the plot, and, you know, maybe add a couple of songs here and a couple of songs there. And then COVID really helped. COVID allowed us a lot of time to really just complete the rest of it. I wrote pretty much most of the second act songs during COVID while I was quarantined, and that eventually kind of led it to its final stage and iteration in about 2024. So it was about a 10-year process writing the musical from where it began to where it is today.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, on WVLP, 103.1 FM. So, George, that's your involvement in this is more of an assist, but you probably brought some, oh, I'll say like a third eye to it, to the process, like with Matt and Scott and Father Stephen. So tell us about how your involvement worked on that.
Yeah. So I guess my initial collaboration was sort of just trying to help record some demo reels or get things recorded for posterity. But you know, after a while, I'd hear one or two songs and I'd say, oh, maybe what about this? Hey, try this. So it was a very gradual sort of entrance into that sort of collaboration. Mostly I was focusing on the idea that, oh, this potentially would be on stage. How would a group producing this handle different things?
You're thinking about the sets and the lighting and all of that, right? Really important.
Yeah. Or having a character on stage left and then all of a sudden on stage right. So, you know, kind of managing the laws of physics as well.
Well, and especially with musicals, that's a major part of what I hated, as you both well know, is I hated to have gaps in a show. Like, that the old traditional close the curtain, set changes. I used to say, okay, look over here. We're going to do something over here while we're doing something else. So yeah, planning the logistics in musicals. And people expect what I call the cinematic type of theater now, where things just constantly change. They don't want to see the curtain close, the orchestra play, and then, yeah. So yeah, that's a major part of staging the whole thing, even before it gets into a directing piece.
When I think like musicals are so ambitious, and it's so wonderful to have new musicals out in the world, and actually it just reads like an old time detective. The language is it's very vibrant and quick and funny, and yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of City of Angels, the musical. You know, it has that kind of feel. I don't know if you've ever seen that one, but it's actually...
Oh, I love City of Angels. Yeah. Yes, that's a high compliment. Thank you.
Yeah, I did when it was at... I think Genesius brought it to the center when I was there. And they were asking how we were going to light this. And I said, this is going to be easy. Because like when they were in the real modern time, it'd be colorful and like regular. But I said, when they went back to the cinematic time, we would go with like almost a not... George will appreciate this, like a very white, non-gel look, a very white. You can't make it quite black and white, but it would look very much more washed out when they were there. So, yeah, that was how I approached that. So anyway, you've got this thing you've done. You know, is actually what you've been describing, Father Stephen, is a workshopping. You've done several workshops. Now you're getting to the final piece. How did that get to Footlight?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, the origin of how we made it to Footlight comes from the very first time that we put the show on, which was in the seminary that I was at the very last year that I was there. So one of my friends at the seminary knew that I was working on this thing and really pushed me to really think seriously about putting it on the stage. And I was a little nervous about putting it on the stage in the seminary. First, because there are women, there's women in the show. So, you know, in a Catholic seminary, there's only guys there. So, you know, pretty much the only shows you can do are like 12 Angry Men and Joseph, you know? So like, I was like, how is this possible? How would it possibly be? But then, you know, I came to realize that there's a couple of staff people who would be interested in coming. There's a commuter student who did theater in high school who was interested in coming in it. So that answered that question. Okay. And then the question two is, we didn't have any drummers in our group, and we knew that drums needed to be a part of the score. I'm like, well, we can't put this musical on because there's no drum score yet. And then magically there is a drummer who appeared in our lap and said, hey, I would love to write a drum score to this thing. So things kind of progressed and dominoes started to fall in such a way that it became very easy for us to just do this show my last year of seminary. And I invited just about anybody who I could think of. You know, I invited everybody around my seminary was in Detroit, so I invited everybody around the Detroit area, but even some connections from Northwest Indiana. And one of them was Anthony Holt, who is the he's one of the directors over at Footlight Players. He's the campus minister over at Marquette Catholic High School. So there was a Catholic connection there. And he came out, he saw it, he loved it, and he wanted to bring it to Footlight. So we had a chance to chat a little bit. We, you know, it's certainly a much different kind of theater Footlight is compared to the theater that it was originally put in, which is, you know, kind of like a bigger proscenium theater. It seats 500 people. We, you know, we had a whole chorus of seminarians. And so Footlight is a little bit different because it's much smaller. It's more intimate. You know, you're not going to have like the massive, you know, you're not going to have like an Oklahoma type chorus, you know, on stage. So it's going to be very interesting to see how that gets transitioned. But originally the musical was written with no chorus. It was originally written with just 10 people. So this is kind of a little bit more true to what our original intent was with The Bluff. So I am very excited to see it performed at the Footlight. And yeah, Anthony Holt was our connection. And I'm really looking forward to it.
So I have a question about, so as you're workshopping it and you said things change. So George, were these like the original names, like Dexter Dahl and Chef Morty? And or did those change, or did the names stay consistent?
I think there's a few changed, a few stayed the same. I think Dexter Dahl might be the only one that stayed throughout the whole thing.
That's such a great name.
I think it was after a character in that murder at the Orange Express was like Dudley Dull or Dudley Sharp or something like that. So it was kind of a straight ripoff from that show. Chef Morty had a different name.
Oh, it's such a great name for the chef.
I think Luella might have stayed Luella, but oh, and Chauncey. Chauncey might have stayed. I think everybody else has a different name.
Very clever names.
So turning this over to someone to direct, neither one of you are part of the directing team. Is that sort of difficult when you kind of let your baby go to someone else to interpret the work?
Yeah, it's difficult in the sense that there's no control. You have no control over it. So we had a chance to, so I was the one who directed the first iteration of it over at the seminary. And I felt, you know, there was a lot of work, but I didn't feel like it was totally out of my control. We had a chance to, there's a local Catholic high school over in Detroit that also put it on. So this is Footlight Theater is the second time that we're kind of letting the baby walk by itself. And I remember walking into that theater feeling so much more nervous than the time that I got to direct it myself. Just because you have no idea how they're going to interpret this line or that line. But I left that theater thinking like, wow, I think they almost did a better job than we did. Like, it was just amazing just seeing. And this is why I love theater so much, is it's such an incarnational art form. Like, you have the script, you have the music, you have the lyrics, but it really becomes its own thing in the present moment. And it's just so wonderful to see what people interpret and how they see what you wrote down. And there are a lot of things that surprised me, and I'm looking forward to what's going to surprise me when I see the Footlight Players put it on.
Anything in the future? Producing a musical, I know I've got one still in the back burner that I've never actually got out into the world. So before I die, I should probably do that. But, you know, do you have anything, you know, okay, we got this one done. Is there any other collaborations down the road?
Well, we're looking for collaborators, I'll tell you that. So, and there's a way that you can contact us. We have a website, so you can reach out to us at thebluffmusical.com. We have like a contact email that you can reach out to. We're the cheapest show in town. We're not looking to make any money. We have other jobs that we're doing. We're just going to basically charge you for us coming to see the show, basically, is the extent of it. Yeah, we'd love to. We're very open to collaborating with, you know, perhaps other artists around Northwest Indiana, you know, other places. We have a couple of, you know, different people that have expressed interest, but nothing hard and fast yet. But we're looking forward to future collaborations with anybody who's interested.
Excellent. And tell us about when it's running, even though we're going to run this show after it. It'll be out there on the web. So tell us about the show dates.
Absolutely. So it's going to run for 3 weekends in September, the last 3 weekends. The first weekend, it'll run from Thursday, September 11th to Sunday, September 14th. The next weekend is September 19th to 21st, and the final weekend, September 26th to 28th. Ticket information can be found on the Footlight Players website. It's footlightplayers.org/upcoming-shows/tickets. You can find them there. Get them while they're available. Who knows how quickly they'll go.
That's true. It's not a lot of seating there. You know, I appreciate you guys coming on. It's kind of like old home week, you know, seeing my theater kids grow up and go off and do something. That's Father Stephen Carraher and George Gerinci. And see, of course, The Bluff. It's a musical murder mystery comedy at the Footlight Players, footlightplayers.org, starting September 11th through the 28th. Hey, thank you so much for coming on Art of the Air and reconnecting.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a blessing to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts, arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at AOTA@breck.com. That's AOTA@breck.com. BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know. Esther and Larry are on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Are on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.